You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney. This is a cycling podcast supported by Rafa and Eurosport. I'm not with my regular colleagues, Richard Moore and Daniel Freeb, today. I've made a solo attack. I'm out on my own, but don't worry. I'm sure we'll be reunited as the podcasting peloton soon enough. But today's episode is slightly different. It's a pilot episode, I guess, or the first of an irregular series, or maybe it'll become a regular series. Who knows? Let's see how this first one goes before I start making any bold promises. But this is Lunch with the Cycling Podcast. I thought, why not combine my two interests, eating and cycling? Daniel is often telling me that I'm thinking of my stomach before I'm thinking of cycling. So why not combine the two and invite somebody to have lunch and we'll have a conversation over lunch rather than a formal interview, questions and answers. See whether it might be a more engaging listen to just have a nice lunch and a chat. We'll see, won't we? But my first guest is Charlie Wigelius, and many of you will know Charlie Wigelius as one of the sports directors of the Cannondale Drapac team. He was a professional for, I think, 12 seasons. He wrote the book on being a domestique, literally. Wrote that with Tom Southam. It's called Domestique. It's excellent if you get a chance to read that. It explains what the life of a rider outside of the limelight is like. And we thought Charlie would be perfect, not least because I emailed him and said, are you over in the UK at any point over the winter? Would you like to meet up and have a chat? And he said that yes, he would be. And his reply was quite simple. He said, this sounds like a perfect excuse for lunch. So there we are. Lunch with the Cycling Podcast was born. And so here I am on a very grey, overcast, quite cold day in November at King's Cross in London, waiting for Charlie to come down from York on the train, where he's been visiting his mum with his wife and two children. Charlie lives in Finland these days, but he's over here in the UK to attend the Ruler Classic, where he'll be helping to unveil Cannondale Drapac's 2017 jersey. Anyway, I booked a table at the Plum and Spilt Milk restaurant, which is kind of inside King's Cross Station. So let's go and meet him. Before I do that, let me just, for those who aren't that familiar, give you a bit of background on Charlie. He was born in Finland in 1978, but brought up in York, where he lived with his mum, Jane, and brother, Eddie. His father represented Finland at show jumping at the 1980 Olympics, so sport within the family. And Charlie decided as a young teenager that he wanted to be a professional cyclist, and he spent his entire teenage years pursuing that dream. And it took him to France and the Vendée U amateur team, which was run then by Jean-René Bernardeau, who is now the boss of the Direct Energy squad. Charlie also rode for the fledgling World Class Performance Plan, which was run by British Cycling at a time when lottery funding was just coming into the sport in Britain and was about to transform the fortunes of a whole generation of riders. Now, Charlie's career almost stopped before it got started because he had an accident on a quad bike in Ireland and lost his spleen, but he recovered from that. He impressed riding for the World Class Performance Plan. And at the start of 2000, he turned professional with MAPEI. And at the time, they were the biggest team in the world by far. And they were putting together a squad of young riders, among them Fabian Cancellara, Filippo Pozzato, Mick Rogers, many more. But then the MAPEI team folded in 2002, and Charlie then experienced the other end of the spectrum, really. He managed to get a contract with a small Italian squad called Dinardi. And then he was basically trying to carve out a role for himself in the peloton, and he established himself as a climbing domestique and impressed enough to earn a move to Liquigas, where he worked for Danilo De Luca, who won the 2007 Giro d'Italia. And by this point he was one of the most respected climbing domestiques in the peloton, and he moved on to Silence Lotto, where he worked for Cadel Evans, the Australian rider. It was a career that spanned 12 years. He rode and finished all three Grand Tours. He rode six or seven Giro d'Italia in a row, but he never won a race, and yet he established a long career. He managed to stay a professional cyclist for more than a decade. It was a career that had a couple of controversial moments. In 2003, he failed the hematocrit health check, and he had to go to great lengths to prove to the UCI that he had a naturally high hematocrit level. And in 2005, he and Tom Southam courted controversy when they accepted a payment to ride on the front of the bunch at the World Championship road race, putting trade team allegiances ahead of the Great Britain team's interests. And that was an incident that had a lot of fallout, very controversial at the time. He finished his career with a small United Healthcare team in 2011, and then he became a sports director with Garmin, who are now Cannondale Drapac. He is now one of the most respected young sports directors currently working in cycling. David Miller once described him as the best sports director in the world, although he probably didn't think that when Charlie Wagelius left him out of the 2014 Tour de France team, which was probably one of Charlie's toughest decisions in sports management so far. Anyway, he'll be getting off his train shortly, so let's go and meet him. Charlie, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Not too bad. I had the pleasure of getting on an English train that was on time.
Wow, that's an exclusive for the podcast, that is. That's lovely. Well, we're in King's Cross. I've booked a table for two at the Plum and Spilt Milk. I hope that's not the extent of the menu. I hope there's a bit more variety than that. So we better go and announce our arrival.
Okay.
Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
I'll take by the way.
Are you sure?
I always keep my back to the wall. All the gangsters do. Do you know, I used to come here when I was a kid to meet my father on the train. And it was quite scary in the 80s coming out of King's Cross. And it's a bit more, it's a bit posher now, isn't it? Yeah.
So what do you reckon? Anything? Have you had a look at the menu?
I had a brief look, yeah. But there don't seem to be any pictures here of the food, so I'm already struggling. I usually just like to point at the picture.
Do you fancy a starter? Or
I think I'll stay away from the starter, actually, because I don't want to be falling asleep, you know, in the afternoon. These heavy working lunches can be a bit dangerous like that, so I think I'll go for that.
Never been for a big lunch with a journalist before, clearly.
No. Usually it's a dusty car park somewhere in the middle of France, isn't it, with the sun over our heads, but makes a nice change.
Well, normally you'd start with maybe three or four pints of really heavy bitter or Guinness or something like that, just to really lull the subject into a false sense of security, but I'm not doing that to you today, Charlie. I hope you appreciate that.
I do, I really appreciate that, getting the soft treatment, yeah.
When I emailed you, Charlie, and suggested we meet up and do this, you said, I think your email was quite succinct. That sounds like lunch to me. Are you a foodie?
I think I know what I like. I wouldn't call myself a big connoisseur, but you don't really live in Italy for 11 years without getting quite a luxurious schooling in food, you know, and I lived many years near Stefano Zanini, or just below him, and he's really what in Varese they call them forchettones, big forks, and he really knows his way around a food table, so I had quite a good mentor in those things. So
I travelled in Italy at the Giro, did a couple of weeks at the Giro. I'd always felt quite intimidated about the prima piatti and the seconda piatti, and I was never quite sure how much you were supposed to have. Were you supposed to go, I mean, obviously I wanted to go through the whole lot, have the starter, the first course, the second course. Didn't really realise until this year that you could pick and choose whatever you want. When you were sort of learning the Italian culture, it's something that must have been a little bit unsettling. You write in your book about how getting to grips with Italy was tricky. Was eating out one of those things that you found difficult as well, or was it because you lived near to Stefano and they took you under their wing?
It was. I mean, I'd lived previously in France to going to Italy, but you know, like you say, you know, like there's quite a sort of disciplined structure to food in Italy. They can tend sometimes to have quite fixed ideas about how things should be done. So no Italian orders a cappuccino past 11 o'clock in the morning, for example. But they don't, when you go a little bit deeper, they don't take themselves as seriously as it might seem. But obviously you kind of get your fingers burnt sometimes. I can remember really like overindulging on these antipastos sometimes at dinners and not realising, because things were lost in translation, that wasn't the entire meal, you know, and then came an entire plate of risotto and then, you know, a huge piece of meat afterwards. But I think part of the reason why I enjoyed living in Italy so much was because they're so welcoming as people, you know, and that counted for food as well. And I can remember I was quite young when I moved first to Italy and I was living on my own, and I remember being so overjoyed at discovering gnocchi. It was a food that took 2 minutes to cook, and you knew it was cooked when it floated. And when you served it, it looked like real food that a real cook would have made. And I just couldn't believe I'd found this. So I overdosed for the first 2 months on gnocchi with these kind of ready pesto sauces, which a lot of Italians kind of turn their noses up because their mothers make them, I suppose. But I thought they were great. Prosciutto, ham and mozzarella. I think I lived on that for 2 months because it was just this, you know, restaurant food made at home.
Somebody of my physique, carbs are the enemy. I mean, you're stick thin, so you can afford yourself the double carb of pasta and potato in the same dish.
Yeah, the double whammy. Although, considering the feedback I just got from Nigel Mitchell, I think my skinny days are a bit behind me. So
that's Nigel Mitchell, the nutritionist at the team, isn't it? What have you been talking to him for? Because it's not essential for your job to you know, maintain some kind of power to weight ratio. You've just got to be able to accelerate and brake in the team car, no?
Yeah, but you know, I try to make use of him as I can, you know, and he gave me some tips about basically, because, you know, I have this terrible habit in the car of like eating through nerves, you know, not through hunger. So I tend to alternate between sugar and salt, chocolate and salt, and that kind of makes your brain a bit slow after a while, which obviously you don't want in the car. So he's given me some tips about that, and I started running just non-competitively, just as a hobby. And I saw him in October in Girona, and just asked him to do my skin folds just out of curiosity, which is the fat percentage test. And I can remember operating on around 33 skin folds when I was a rider, and I was 70 now. So I think I'm what the Italians call a falso magro. A false skinny person. So I've got a little belt of fat, beer-fueled fat here around my stomach that no one can see, but apparently, according to Nigel, is there, so he found me out quite quickly.
Talking about eating in the car, it must be easy just to graze your way through a four-hour stage.
Yeah, I'm terrible for that. I mean, my diet, compared to how it... I mean, I'm married to a farmer's daughter, so I eat quite well at home. And, you know, there's not much sugar in the house and there's not much sugary drinks and so on, but I'm just terrible at the races. I just start munching on anything I can find my hands on, just because I'm thinking and because I'm nervous and so on. So try and fill the car with nuts and dried fruit now, and just it's not so much about my weight or anything, but just doesn't really help the brain, I don't think, to fill your body with that kind of food.
Yeah, because late in the afternoon, if you've had a big doughy lunch and you're trying to concentrate in the car,
25 kilometres to go, you need to be sort of on the top of your game, don't you, and not slowing down, you know, and nodding off. So, yeah.
So, growing up in New York, I don't want to be overly personal, but your parents had split up. Growing up in a single parent family with an unusual-ish surname, did people struggle to pronounce that when you were at school?
Oh, I've heard all the different machinations of the name, but I got used to it. And I think the hardest thing was having to wear a woolly hat when I went to school, because kids didn't really do that in England. And I think the Finnish traditions meant that I got sent off with a hat on. And I always got round the corner and took it off as soon as I got round the corner from home. But it was I had a nice upbringing. It was nice.
Yeah, it didn't strike me that you wouldn't have known any different, of course, but splitting between York most of the year and then going to Finland, what was Finland like as a young boy, as a place to go and visit?
I think for my brother and I, it was kind of a bit of a giant adventure playground. I don't know whether things were safer for kids then or parents just trusted the world a bit more, but we were left a pretty long reign. And I started travelling very early with my brother between England and Finland on our own. So we had quite a sort of independent sort of life, I suppose. And when we were in Finland, you know, there's a lot of open spaces, and we lived in the countryside, and we were travelling around, going to different horse competitions, spending time with my grandparents and so on, you know, in the archipelago in Finland. So I can't really complain. It was pretty free summers we spent.
And you're back in Finland now. You live there with your wife, two children.
That's right, yeah.
And towards the end of the book, you talk about making that decision to move away from Italy to Finland. I mean, what's it like over there? I mean, it's the cliche that I imagine at this time of year, very short days, very dark. It's not off-putting in any way. What's it like over there?
It's not easy. The wind, like, you know, November and December are tough. And I think that, I suppose the climate's a bit reflected in the people in the same way that it is in Italy. In that they're quite shy people. They can be quite hard to, you know, break through at first, to get to know them. Life moves at a different pace. But, you know, I can't think of anywhere I'd want to be bringing up a young family better than being in Finland. You know, things are incredibly functional, children are really well looked after, very family orientated. And I think kind of socially, you know, you have to work harder to make relationships with people, but they're very genuine when you have them. And obviously with the work that I do and the travel that I do, having my wife with kind of home court advantage when I'm away is a big plus. You know, she's got a bit more support and things are much more familiar than being stuck somewhere in Southern Europe.
And how did it work with the work that you do? Because I suppose the big difference between being a sports director and being a rider is that there's perhaps less occasions when you're suddenly called up to go to work at short notice. One of the things in the book is your frustration, particularly towards the end, at being called up to do races at the last moment, filling in for somebody because you were dependable, reliable, and would you know, do your best. But that had an impact on home life, having to suddenly jet off. Presumably, as a sports director, you can more or less map your year in quarters, if not in halves. You know roughly what you're going to be doing.
Yeah. It's ironic. Now I'm the guy who has to call people up and ask them to go to races at the last minute. So I've become the boogeyman. Yeah, I mean, the sports directors tend to get sick a lot less than riders. So generally, when we have a plan, it stays more or less as it is. So that's nice. And of course, you know, I'm not out on my bike for 6 hours a day when I'm at home, so I can generally move things around the family when I'm at home. So the people in America wake up a bit later, and, you know, information comes in from there later on when the kids are in bed, so I can deal with that, and then I can work in the mornings and so on. So it's a pretty flexible working day at home, really, you know. So, and with, you know, with technology and email and all these things, you can you can do a lot from a distance, and you have to because the team is so dispersed. It wouldn't really matter whether I was in Amsterdam or Helsinki. You'd still have to use a machine to communicate with people. So
are you in Helsinki itself, or are you out in a smaller town?
Yeah, we live in the middle of Helsinki, and that's really, it's really great because, you know, you walk on the street and I think you hear as many foreign languages as you do Finnish on the street, you know, and there's all kinds of different people there, and nobody's really minding what other people are doing. And, you know, my oldest son, he's never really spoken English with me. I always speak English with him, but he only ever answers in Swedish. And I heard his first English words the other day, and he said, "Oh man, give me a break." And I thought, what? I never usually say that. And then I found out that there was a kid at his daycare with American parents, and he got it from there. So there's all kinds of different languages, and it's like a real melting pot, you know. So it's nice for them to get like a pretty broad view of the world from there. So it's nice.
And so tell me, what work does a sports director have to do at kind of this time of year, or when they're not at races? Because I imagine a lot of people will think that your job turns on and off when you're actually at races or training camps, and there's nothing really else to do.
Yeah, I mean, I could rabbit on about this all afternoon, and I think they'd probably chuck us out of this restaurant by then. But I think the short answer is that we try and just basically remove as many things that block the riders from having a free run at doing the best, basically. And that can mean, you know, putting them in touch with the right people to get their backs fixed or their position fixed, or checking in that everything's running smoothly. And that's a job that we split up between us. And then a large part of it is basically making strategic decisions about how to use the 27 or 30...
The wine has arrived. Better test it, Charlie.
That's fine, thank you. Yeah. I can feel JV looking at me whenever I test wine. I can feel him peering over me.
Is under pressure to pick the right one. I mean, he is a fellow of the Chateau Neuf du Pape Society, isn't he? He really knows his wine.
His wife's, I'm not sure what qualification is that she got, but she's extremely highly qualified, I think, so there's a lot of pressure.
So you're trying to manage and not just the racing lives of 25 or so riders all spread across the world, you're trying to then bring them together to races. Are you setting race programs at the moment? Is that how it works?
Yeah, I mean, basically we've got to take 27 riders who are kind of individuals at the start of the process, who have a short career and short contracts, and put them together and have them work towards a common goal or a common set of goals, and find something for them in each of their programs, and get value out of the riders as much as we can. So first you establish the race calendar, which is obviously a lot more, in some ways it's more simple nowadays than it was in the past, because the World Tour calendar blocks out a lot of our time commitment. Make a racing calendar, then try and get, you know, 27 riders on a racing schedule that has a logic to it, that has realistic objectives, rest periods and preparation periods. And it's a bit like a Rubik's Cube, you know. I found it quite interesting. Andreas Klier came, and we had kind of like a sort of like a brainstorming session last year, and we did it together, and he'd never been that close on that process before, and in an hour and a half we kind of did 80% of it, and I thought this was easy, you know. And I sort of had a bit of a smile, you know, because I knew what was coming, because you do the first block of it and you think you've got it nailed, and then the rest of it takes a month, because you think you've done it, and then you've got kind of 12 riders riding Tirreno Adriatico and 3 riders riding Paris-Nice, and then you change it, and that all has like a knock-on effect on the other races. So you're fixing one thing, and then it puts something out, and then it takes a while to get it kind of nailed down.
So how do you go through that process? I mean, obviously you have to negotiate with the riders, the top riders will have much more say over their program than the lesser riders. But you have to presumably pick your objectives, whether that's the Giro or the Tour, and work back from there. You can't have somebody who's going to the Giro and then suddenly look at the list and go, oh, we've only given him 7 days of racing between January and May. So you're putting all these pieces together whilst bearing in mind that they're not just chess pieces to move around, they're also people.
I mean, it's like anything, it's like a rider, you know, he can train without any specific kind of effort and come to the races, and like this, you know, you can do it and you can fill it in 2 hours if you want to, but if you really want to get the most out of every rider and really kind of maximise things, it takes quite a bit of effort. So the first thing that I do is I speak to Jonathan Waters, and he gives me basically the big picture about what the goals are of the team. And I think that he kind of does the goals, you know, what the commercial objectives are, what the sports objectives are, and how that fits in with the stuff that he deals with, you know, the really big picture stuff. And then I try and put that into practice kind of on the strategic level. So I know from him what our most important races are, and we have a lot of sort of backwards and forwards. And then I just basically start to try and put the riders together. And in a way, it's not as complex as it sounds, because there's certain pathways to certain objectives. So, you know, if you're going to prepare for the Giro, you know that there's going to be a certain amount of race days that you need there. And then you can start to think about, you know, do you ride Romandy or Trentino, or do you go to altitude here, or do you skip the races? But there's a certain set of races that you can choose from. And the same goes for the classics, and the same goes for the Tour. So it's not super complex on that side.
In terms of being, you know, because you're head sports director, aren't you? Is that your title?
I suppose so, yeah.
I've seen you described as head lead sports director, whatever the terminology is.
But we don't really do kind of titles in the Cannondale Draft Pack, so we just sort of...
What though is, I mean, because obviously this 2016 season, you've ended the season without a World Tour win, which obviously does stand out like a bit of a sore thumb to people looking at the team, and yet finished halfway up the World Tour rankings.
Behind Etics Quickstep. So
was the objective a high World Tour position, or was it to try and win some bike races?
I mean, the objective for us is always to win races when we can. And I think if you look at our team, the next objective after that is always to try and race in an entertaining, energetic way that people like. I think that's kind of our identity, I suppose, as a team. And of course, if you look at the team statistically, it doesn't look great. But Rigoberto was really on track to do a really great Giro. And I think a lot of people thought he was already sunk after, you know, 12 days or so. And I think the fact that he came back so strong in the last week was testimony to the shape that he had, because he was sick, you know, and a lot of riders who weren't in such good shape would have just fallen by the wayside. But he came back because he was in, so he could have done a lot better there. Same goes for the Tour. You know, Pierre Rolland really, by all rights, should have gone home. And I think he could have been really entertaining and got some big results at the Tour. And then, you know, I think we performed really well over the second part of the season. But there was the issue of the points always in the back of our head as well. And, you know, that at times can condition the strategy in races. And although, you know, there's obviously a lot of discussion about points and what they mean in cycling and so on, but if you think about how the team performed, you don't score points by being at the back of the races. So if we finished eighth overall, you know, in a very, very competitive environment, we did something right. Did we want to win more? Of course we did. But I think, you know, finishing eighth isn't something that we should be ashamed of at all. It means that we had a very strong second part to the season, you know. And for a team like ours that is still the youngest team in the World Tour for the second year in a row, you know, we put two riders in the top 10 at the Vuelta. We put Andrew himself, but, we know, with our help, we put him back on track, which I think a lot of people wouldn't have thought was possible in, you know, April or May. So there's a lot of positives, and in an extremely competitive environment, you know. So think there's a lot of hope to go forward.
One of the big things that Jonathan talked about, and one of the biggest challenges when that is your strategy, is that with short-term contracts for riders, you could find yourself in a position where you're investing a lot in a rider's development, and then they get lured away by somebody else who then reaps the rewards of that investment. And I suppose, you know, when you look back at your career and how you started with the MAPE team that had that development squad of young riders, I mean, when I look back at that, you were in it, Filippo Pozzato, Fabian Cancellara, Dario Cioni, Mick Rogers, I think, was in it as well. I mean, that's quite a high strike rate of riders who went on to have good careers, but they, of course, went on to have good careers for another team because MAPE, the sponsor, pulled out. And in 16, 17 years, nothing really has changed, has it, in the way that cycling is structured?
Yeah, I feel like an old fart sometimes, you know, always, you know, going back to what happened when I was a rider in MAPE. But I think it's really, you know, despite the fact that I was there, it's fair to say that things have been dressed up in a different way for marketing reasons over the years, but nobody in 15, 16 years has come close to creating what they did. Because, you know, everywhere you read now and you listen on podcasts and so on in cycling now, that the problem people talk about is a lack of long-term vision in cycling. And Giorgio Squinzi and the MAPE group had a long-term vision for cycling, and that was the Young Riders group. And that was a big sponsor with the courage and the sensibility for the development of riders to put money into long-term development. And like you say, nobody does that now because there's no return on it and people are struggling to survive and so on and so on. You know, and people do very high-tech things now, but basically I think what they did there should be a model because, like you say, what they produced was of really high quality and it lasted through years. And if you think of MAPE as a soccer team or something, that investment would have paid back itself over and over again because relatively small amounts of money is invested in those riders in those key years of their careers saw a huge sort of return on the investment over the years. So for me, that would be the model of development, but again, there's always lacking the long-term stability to be able to put that into place.
Thinking back to when you turned pro, when you were a kid, I'm assuming you weren't dreaming of being a domestique in the world of professional cycling, and in your book you talk about when the penny kind of dropped for you and you realised you could make a career as one of the worker bees in the peloton. When you're dealing with a rider now and they're on the cusp of coming to that realisation that they're perhaps not going to be one of the stars, is that something that you're able to help riders with, talk to them about, you know, you can still stay in this sport if you are prepared to you know, to do that work?
Yeah, I mean, it's something I feel quite strongly about, but it can go in both directions, you know. Obviously, cycling changed a lot in the short time since I was a rider. Because I think there's less and less riders every year who can justify a solid career without ever winning anything. It's just moving in a different direction. So I see riders, and I can see certain riders switching off too early in the way that I did, you know, finding a comfort zone, finding regular employment and just losing that ambition and that desire to just try one day to go and win a stage. And I obviously find, you know, I can see myself in that. But then you see other riders who struggle to make the realization that they're going to have much better employment prospects by making themselves useful. And you see riders who are, you know, they've still got this fire of ambition, but they don't see where small victories or no victories when you're trying to win, how they fit in the system, you know. Because helping somebody win something big is always going to have a lot more value than trying to win something and not succeeding. And I think that's something a lot of riders struggle with. So it's a two-sided thing, but I hope I can help with that with riders.
They often say in other sports, particularly football, that it's not necessarily the best players who make the best managers. Do you think there's that kind of applies to cycling as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely having been a bad enough rider. I mean, you have to know what it tastes to have a bit of shit between your teeth, honestly. And to sit in a gruppetto and have it called a laughing group and just feel miserable. I think that gives you a good perspective as a director. So I think it helps, you know, because if you have massive talent and you just kind of glide through your career, it's going to be hard to empathise with the guy who's kind of struggling at the back and wondering where his next contract's coming from. So I think it helps.
Oh, lunch is here. Perfect. Thank you. Dig in, and I won't tell anyone if you want to share my fries, Charlie.
There we go. You can't flick a flicker, can you?
I decided to stop recording while we ate because I didn't think that the clanking of cutlery and chewing sounds would make a particularly pleasant listen for all of you out there. I do remember at the 2013 Tour de France at Mont Saint-Michel, Richard Daniel and I recorded a podcast over dinner, and I ordered the moule frites, which were very nice, but when we listened back to the recording we realised that the sound of mussel shells scraping in the bowl was not particularly pleasant. Anyway, we were having lunch here at the Plum and Spilt Milk, which is part of the Great Northern Hotel at King's Cross Station in central London. It takes its name from the distinctive livery of the Flying Scotsman dining car, which is sort of purple and cream, or Plum and Spilt Milk. It's fairly explanatory, really. It was not a particularly cheap place, which you might expect given its location, but it was relaxing, a nice atmosphere inside, and I was quite relieved to see that the tables were not crammed too close together. I never like to be hemmed in a restaurant anyway, but when I'm trying to record a conversation with somebody, you don't want earwiggers earwigging particularly, and I wanted Charlie to feel as relaxed as possible, really. As lunchtime wore on, the restaurant did fill up, it got livelier, and so during the second half, which you're about to listen to, there's perhaps a bit more hustle, bustle and chatter in the background, but hopefully it's not too obtrusive. Anyway, for the most important bit, the lunch, Charlie and I both had the fillet of cod with brown shrimps and citrus butter. It was very nice. I'm never too sure about pieces of orange and pink grapefruit on top of a lovely piece of fish, but it did work well. Anyway, after lunch, we continued our conversation.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Did you enjoy that, Charlie?
I did. It was delicious. I think I should admit to the listeners that I did nick a few of your chips, though. So, just full disclosure there.
There was enough of them. It's fine. I won't. And I'm not going to waste away, am I? Let's be honest. Let's go back to sort of the beginning and work through your career a little bit. It just struck me while I was reading your book again, Domestique, that I was actually in the Great Britain team car behind you in the under 23 time trial at the World Championships in 99, when the day you signed your contract, or the day you certainly were offered the contract by the Mapei Super Team, as they were, you know, really the sort of Manchester City / Chelsea of professional cycling, as they were at the time.
Yeah. I think if I think back on that period, it was probably what old people would call the days of your lives, you know. It was a lot of intense memories from a really short period of time. And I'll never forget the hotel where I signed my contract. I'll never forget the whole process of signing it. And obviously that was wrapped around riding the World Championships, which was a big deal for me at the time because I was pretty competitive. But just, you know, being in Italy for the first time, and like, I'll never forget the colours of the, you know, that kind of low-level sunlight there is at the end of October in Italy. And I can remember, as soon as I signed the contract, I got sort of like sucked into the Mapei machine, you know. And one day I was just me with John Herity and Ernie the mechanic. And the next day I was watching the professional race on the Mapei bus, and then I was taken with some riders who, Chan McRae, who just finished I think fifth or something in that race, was taken with them back to Varese, and then I got to see the Patrick Lefebvre showed me the houses that we were going to be living in the next year, and I'd stayed in some pretty shabby digs in my time, and then he showed me this place, you know, on the lakeside near Varese with the swimming pool and the swans and stuff, and it was just this incredibly surreal kind of 10-day period, you know. And I can never forget, I went to see the secretary at the Mapei Centre just before I left, because she was rebooking my ticket to go back to Manchester, and she's just so apologetic that she couldn't find a ticket because it was last minute, but the only one we could find was in business. So I ended up flying home in business with my shitty running shoes on and my Great Britain tracksuit on, and it was just a really very exciting period of my life, but pretty intense, I think, when I look back on it.
Probably done Mapei a bit of a disservice calling them Manchester City or Chelsea. They were the Galacticos of cycling at the time, although they didn't ever win the Tour de France. That was a bit of a gap in the, but they dominated classics. Had a lot of the top riders of the time, people you would have ridden with, Paolo Bettini, Oscar Freire.
It was just giant, and you could feel in everything that you were part of something really big, just the way things worked and the way things were, and you know, coming out of like an amateur career or a young rider's career and just going straight into that, it was kind of overwhelming at times. I remember we went, I think in the end of October, we had a meeting in Stresa, you know, just to take measurements for clothes and things, and I arrived and I went up to my room and I was sharing a room with Johan Museo. So I came into this hotel room and he was there lying on his bed reading a magazine, and it was just like, it was really odd. And I just couldn't sleep because I didn't want to move in the bed and disturb him, so I just kind of laid there all night just awake. But it was really, really exciting times for me.
Did you sense any resentment from other riders on other teams because of the resources and the backing that Mapei had? I know Team Sky, for example, sometimes not the most popular team in the peloton these days because the perception that they have more than everybody else.
Yeah, at times I have to say you felt that, especially with the young riders group, because we were often riding, or we generally rode kind of the second rung European races with the, what were they called, second division teams at the time. So we were riding the Tour of Normandy and the Tour of Slovenia and the Tour of Denmark. And of course with us, you know, if the race organisers didn't provide something that we needed, the team just bought it. And in those days, for smaller teams, that wasn't necessarily a given. So we were often sort of running on a different level. And we had a pretty charmed existence. I mean, everything that we ever needed to perform was just put in place, you know, the testing and the training and the material. And I mean, we were riding on bikes that at the time were just the most desirable bikes in the world, and like I say, you know, riding against teams that didn't necessarily have everything they needed, so we were kind of the golden boys of the young rider scene, I suppose.
That would have been the Colnago, wouldn't it, the C50 at the time, was it?
C40, yeah. And it's one of the few regrets that I have that I didn't buy my bike when the team ended.
Did you have the option to?
Yeah, you could always buy a bike at the end of the year. But you're just thinking about the next season at the time, aren't you? And I think it would be a collector's item by now. Not because I rode it, but just because it was a...
And then really from one extreme to the other, you're very complimentary really about Dinardi in terms of the world they operated in as a small Italian team, probably at the better end of that spectrum at the time. But it was from one extreme to the other. And I get the sense from your book that's when you really learned what cycling was all about and you know how hard it was to establish and make a living and continue to make a living in the sport.
Yeah, I like to think I didn't go around with my eyes closed the whole time, but there was definitely a bump to earth when I went to Dinardi because, you know, Stanger ran a very good operation and a very functional operation, but there was absolutely no frills. It was strictly functional. So, I mean, I got my bike and all my clothing at the end of November, which isn't an easy thing for teams to provide, you know. But everything worked just fine. But there was absolutely nothing extra. So we didn't get eau de cologne to clean our legs. We got this kind of lighter fluid that people use to... This kind of red... I'll never forget the smell of it. I think people use it to light barbecues or clean patios or whatever. And instead of, you know, this kind of baby-scented eau de cologne. And they'd just rub it on our legs and your legs would just burn, but they'd just be clean. So it worked. And I suppose that sums it up, really.
So you go home from a race smelling like a petrol station.
Yeah, no naked flames around these. Especially because I think the tracksuits we had were pretty flammable too as well. Yeah.
Now, just touch on the couple of controversies that were a part of your career. First of all, I think it was 2003, the routine hematocrit test, which at the time... was a test to determine the percentage of red blood cells, and there was a 50% threshold applied by the UCI, and if you were over that 50% threshold you were prevented from racing, I think, for 14 days or 21 days or but of course the association was that because the hematocrit test had been brought in to try and curb rampant EPO use, and so this It was like a sort of red flag in some cases, but in your case, basically there was there was damage to your reputation because people drew from the test result that was an indication of doping, and you had to go kind of beyond. There was no real help from the UCI to do this, but you had to go beyond the kind of call of duty to try and establish that you had a naturally high hematocrit and clear your name. Tell me about that period.
Yeah, I mean, it was basically a kind of de facto positive test for as far as public opinion was concerned. And if you look back on it now, I think the UCI was obviously doing the best they could with a pretty poor hand because they didn't have a test. So, you know, you can think what you like about that, but that was with the best that they could come up with at the time. And I still read occasionally, you know, people who say, with more or less facts behind what they say, you know, that it's not really possible to have more than 50% hematocrit naturally. So I was aware before that test that I had high values. I'd had high values since the first test I ever had, you know, when I was a rider, like getting routine blood tests. And I knew that there was a risk of it, but there wasn't really much I could do. I don't think I ever took seriously or ever really imagined, I suppose, what the consequences would be. But it was incredibly traumatic for me because I knew what it meant in public opinion. I lost my job immediately. I was, you know... I felt like I was being blamed. And I knew that I had naturally high values, and I really felt... And, you know, the whole process was incredibly open-ended, you know. I wasn't told... If you can prove X, Y, and Z, then it'll be definitively. It was just I could go to Lausanne and have some tests and then show them what I had and we'll see. You know? And even at the end of that, it isn't a negative test. It's just a certificate. And it's just kind of left to this kind of grey thing. And I didn't know whether I'd get my job back at the end of it either. Didn't have a lot of money. It cost me a lot of money. And it was the end of the season, and I didn't have a contract, and it was just this standing over the edge of a cliff. And there was no kind of protocol as to what information they needed to prove it. So I got blood tests from my father, and he has, you know, routinely 54-55% hematocrit and takes aspirin on a regular basis to keep his blood values down. Luckily, my trainer from when I was a young rider, Ken Matheson, he had a lot of documentation from when I was, you know, 16 years old. And then I went to Lausanne and they basically put me under various different... Because it's a value that fluctuates to do with mostly hydration. So they basically put me under various different conditions to see how my bloods would react. So they tested me in the morning and the evening and they dehydrated me and they sent me out training. And then I just had to sit at home and wait. And that was a really low time for me, and I sitted and waited, and then, kind of typical of cycling, I got this little certificate, and then everything is back as it was. And I got the contract back, and I started off again, but it was pretty rough to go through.
because at the time they didn't take into account the age of red blood cells to see whether there are any young ones being produced, which would be an indicator of the high, naturally high value, whereas if they were all old red blood cells, it would indicate that they were either synthetic or you know, the result of an illegal transfusion. And so, you know, as eventually they introduced a biological passport, and I suppose your case is almost one of those little steps on the journey towards that kind of...
I mean, basically, if I would have drunk a massive amount of water, which isn't a banned substance, before that test that morning in Lombardy, I probably would have been under. Or if I would have had a drip of liquids or whatever. I was just... You know, and since I started the biological passport, I had values over 50, you know, really high values, but obviously it didn't flag anything because everything was... Other values were being followed. So I understand what they were doing and why they were doing it. They were trying to do their best, but for me personally, it was pretty rough.
Did you feel resentful, or are you still kind of resentful that you had to go through that?
I did at the time, but I don't anymore. There's a lot happened in my life since then, and a lot worse happens to other people, and I came out of it okay, and I was allowed, you know, I managed to, you know, have a good career after that. So it was unfortunate, and I wish it hadn't happened, but can't drag it behind me forever.
And the other sort of bump in the road for your career, I guess, was the 2005 World Championships in Madrid, where you and Tom Thusam, who ended up ghostwriting your book, I don't know whether to hold him responsible for all the swearing in it, Charlie.
He cut a lot of it out, I think. So, but I swear a lot less nowadays, so the public can be reassured.
Well, you're in a position of responsibility now, Charlie, aren't you?
More than anything else, yeah.
So the 2005 Worlds in Madrid, you and Tom were part of a, I think, five-man British team. Roger Hammond was the leader of.
Yeah, I think it was five riders, yeah.
And tell me how that race panned out.
Well, I mean, I think the specifics of the story are pretty well established. But we didn't follow team orders, and there was a big kerfuffle afterwards.
Well, let me put a bit of meat on the skeleton there. You were paid by somebody who you don't actually identify in the book, €2,500 to do a bit of teamwork for somebody other than the GB team, and I think for at least a couple of laps, maybe more, you and Tom were swapping turns on the front of the peloton, which was an unusual-ish tactic, but I suppose, I mean, as you say, we tried to claim that you were working also for Roger Hammond, because as the team's designated sprinter, he wanted the race to come back together as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happened there was that we were victims of the beginnings of the sort of full media age, you know, that the race was shown live for the whole race. People didn't have a great deal to talk about. We did something that didn't go in any way against the interests of the British team that day, but it wasn't part of the plan. So there wasn't a British rider in the break, for example, and of course we would never have done that. But we didn't do the right thing. We did the wrong thing. But it's something that's been a part of cycling for years, and it continues to be a part of cycling. I really regret it, obviously, because it had a... You know, it's one of the two negative things that you thought to mention while we're having lunch in 2016. And of course I regret it, because it came, you know, it was the wrong thing to do. And it cost me a lot in terms of stress and damage to my reputation. And I understand now that there's people who are never going to accept what I did or understand it. And there's a lot of people, I think, who do understand it and why, and the position that we were in and what kind of life we led in those days. I'm okay with both of those scenarios, honestly. And you go through life and you make mistakes and you live with them, and people either agree with them or they don't, and I go on with my life and I can't go back and change it, and it is what it was. I do feel a bit sad, I suppose, that there wasn't more of an effort made at the time to kind of understand what we were going through, you know, and the position that we were in and how cycling worked, you know, and since then these kinds of things have happened on lots of occasions. And, you know, people seem to understand it more now, but we didn't have that kind of understanding at the time.
Yeah, because in the book you kind of make it clear that from your point of view it wasn't just about accepting a payment, it was more about earning respect from peers and showing that you could be professional, really, in the sort of Italian cycling sense of the word, which was the world you were in at the time.
Yeah, stepping up when you're asked to step up. I mean, I made a mistake also to do it because I don't think my understanding of what the British cycling team was keeping track with current events. You know, because there were many national teams in those days of nations that went to the Worlds, and they were just kind of journeymen, professional riders, and they'd go and ride the race, and the national team didn't expect anything. And until just a few months before, that had been the case of the British team. But it was changing so fast that there were expectations, and it was kind of becoming a real team. You know, I mean, I remember in 2004, I rang John before the Verona Worlds and said, you know, I just feel so terrible in the races. I don't want to come and ride because I'm just a disgrace. Because I was just creeping, you know. I was at the end of my season and I was knackered, and I didn't see the point in going to the Worlds. And he said, can you just not come and ride? And I came and rode because it was an hour and a half drive away, and I rode.
And you like John Herity, the team manager.
And, you know, I was living on my own in Italy, and it was nice to spend a few days with John and the team, and they didn't have anybody else to put in there, and I kind of like just hung out for a while, and it was nice to be with an English... And that's what the British team was 12 months before. And my view of it, because I was so detached, just didn't really follow in time with it. And it was a big deal then, by 2005, and that was 12 months later.
Now, as a sports director, how do you look back on that? I mean, it's kind of anachronistic almost, having a national team set up for the World Championships. Very hard to police, very hard. One of the kind of the side stories is always looking out for trade team allegiances taking precedence over national team allegiances, perhaps. And you always wonder, you know, who's working for who. And somebody will always say, oh, well, there's four Sky riders there and there's, you know, three Etix Quickstep riders there.
That's exactly the view that... That's how I thought of it when I was a rider in 2005. And when I did that, that's what... I mean, I didn't even think that there'd be a reaction. Because that's how I thought that you guys thought of it in the media. I wasn't thinking about, you know, treachery and, you know, being put into the... what's it called, the tower here, the Tower of London, you know, because I just kind of, for me it was just kind of a given, yeah, I just massively underestimated how people would take something like that and how it would be interpreted.
Well, just to explain, it was interpreted because British cycling was publicly funded to a great degree and they were trying to step up the way they worked and revise. They weren't just going to be a collection of individuals, or they were going to have a plan and work towards that plan. Obviously, with a sort of long-term goal, word did reach me that, you know, Peter Keane, who was the architect of the world-class performance plan as it was in the late 90s, you know, he was watching on TV that day, sort of tearing his hair out, wondering why the two British riders are on the front, you know, and obviously it caused a much bigger rumpus than you would have anticipated.
Yeah, but that plan wasn't communicated to us, was it? So
you were still in the era of the kind of the guns for hire, being called up into the national team, really, without, you know, having you, like you say, you weren't necessarily riding against the interests of Roger Hammond, because his interest would have been to keep the bunch together.
No. I mean, I could go on about this all afternoon, but it's not going to change the fact that what I did was wrong, you know? And people have different opinions about it. And, you know, this was a time when I was fighting for contracts when other British riders who were on the British programme were being farmed out to European teams at British Cycling's cost in direct competition with me. You know, so it was a pretty fast-changing situation. You know, when they were beginning to place riders in European teams while they were paying for their salaries.
So while you were out there trying to earn a contract on your own.
Yeah, and clearly that plan wasn't... I wasn't a part of that plan and it wasn't communicated to me. So retrospectively, they probably would have been better advised just not to bring me if I wasn't part of their plan.
So thinking now as in your role as a sports director, dealing with young men who have insecure futures, they may have a couple of years contract, some rare riders may have multi-years, three plus year contract, but they're still very much in the minority, aren't they? Does all of your career experience inform how to manage people and try and understand what their individual motivations are, that perhaps asking a rider in the final year of his contract to do a job rather than asking a rider with 2 years on his contract, does any of that come into your thinking at all?
I think what I'd say is that I have now a lot more perspective, because I can remember what it was like to be a rider and I know what I was like, but I can also see a little bit further because of where I stand now. And an athlete, by his description, is kind of in a tunnel, you know, and he's looking at the world in a microscope and he's thinking about his next race and his next training ride, and you can be very short-sighted like that. And what I did in Madrid was obviously incredibly short-sighted, because I didn't see what was happening all around me. I didn't see where British cycling was going and what it was being and so on. And that's probably a big reason why I was never a part of it, because of what happened that day. Maybe there's other reasons, I don't know. But a rider or an athlete doesn't generally see beyond the front of his nose, because he's just concentrating on the next thing. And, you know, like you say, they've got short contracts and they're just trying to... So sometimes they can do things that are kind of against their own interest because they don't see further down the road. So sometimes if you can try and help them to see that, then it can be helpful for them.
And lastly, on your sports director role, you seem to have a very even temperament, not somebody who loses... Are you a teacup throwing sports director who lay down the law in a sort of an angry fashion? Because there's a very brief passage in your book where you talk about seeing your wife to be for the first time, Camilla, and she's part of a show jumping training session, I guess you call it, that was being run by your dad. And one of the things that I picked up from that was that your dad must be quite authoritarian when it comes to that, and your wife, now wife, was willing to kind of kick back against that a bit. But I don't see you as a... I don't want to say you're a soft touch at all, but I don't see you as an iron-fisted kind of, you know... Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I don't think I'm iron-fisted, but I have quite a quick temper. But as I'm getting older, I'm learning to keep under control and to manage it a bit more. So I have moments where I kind of... I wouldn't say I even get angry, but I get worked up really quickly. But I'm learning to just let that go by. And so I hope it doesn't interfere with my decision-making very often. And I hope I don't show it inappropriately to the riders too often. I know I have done. But I think in those times I've done it to try and get the best out of them, because I think it's also helpful to show some emotion sometimes. But kind of in principle, I think that, you know, if they need shouting at or screaming at, then there's something gone wrong before, because they're all pretty highly motivated. So I try and keep it under control. But emotion's part of the sport, you know. So in the car, I get pretty wound up in the races.
You said nervous earlier. But is that partly because you can't actually influence what's going on?
There's an element to that, I think, you know, because you kind of throw the dice, and but you've really got to let the riders ride. Also, because you can't just radio control them despite what people think, and also because I don't think it's productive.
Because they've got to make their own decisions and learn from any mistakes they make, I guess, rather than just being told what to do.
Yeah, but less as a training thing, but just as like as the race goes. You've got to react really quickly and instinctively, and they've got good instincts, that's why they're good bike riders, and you've got to try and let them be what they are. But that's, it's not hard to manage from the car, because you just kind of get a bit wound up. So I've got a bit of a temper, but I think I keep it away from the riders as much as I can.
So what else will you be doing while you're over here in the UK before you head back to the snowy, cold winter in Finland?
So I've got I'm going to go to the Ruleur event this afternoon, where POC is unveiling the new Cannondale Trackpack jersey for next year. And I'm also going to go to, I think I'm going to have to go over the border from Yorkshire into Lancashire, because I'm going to meet with Hugh Carthy and his trainer, Ken Matheson, just have a chat about next season and put some plans down.
Ken Matheson was your trainer back in the day, and Hugh Carthy, it strikes me, has trod a similar path to you, gone across to Europe and attracted attention outside of what the British cycling system that now exists.
Yeah. Ken was one of only two trainers I had. He trained me until I turned professional, and then Aldo Sassi trained me while I was a rider. So Ken, I think he did me a King Cycle test. I think it was probably in November of 1994 at Leeds Swimming Pool. And if I don't have it on paper at home, he definitely has, because he's very organised. And he followed me all the way to when I was in France, and all the way to when I became a professional. So it's kind of, it's nice, but it's a bit strange that now he's training a rider who rides for Cannondale.
Are you looking forward to working with Hugh? He's a gifted climber. There's hardly anything of him. He's come through a sort of European, he's learnt the ropes of European cycling, and now he'll be incorporated into the Cannondale Drapac team next year. What are you hoping from Hugh Carthy next year?
I think he showed a lot of grit, really, and determination to get where he got. And I think they're the biggest qualities that are going to send him further along the way. And he did it without any kind of real support, and I hope we can give him that extra support that will help him step up. But really, he just needs to keep doing what he's done until now, because it's functional, because it's obviously doing great. But he needs time to develop, because he's still young. So I hope that that he'll keep the same mentality, and that we can add positively to that without, you know, distracting him or changing him in a negative way. So just kind of add some blocks on top of it, and then just see where the road takes him. But he's got a great mentality. He's got a very independent, hard-working work ethic, and he's very realistic. And I think, you know, he's made a lot of tough decisions, and he's sticking by them, because he's staying in Pamplona. You know, it was one of the first things he asked is, can I please stay and live in Pamplona? So that shows me that the decisions he made were real ones. They weren't just, you know, because he's still staying there, he doesn't have to. So he's really got a basis to what he's doing, so I hope it's promising for the future.
Not bad for somebody from Lancashire, eh, Charlie?
Yeah, well, we've got a Yorkshireman, someone from Lancashire, and someone from Wales next year. And what's Tom? Is he Cornwall or Devon? Devon. Yeah, got to be careful with that. So we've got quite a mix going on there, so it could get a bit feisty this year. We'll have to see.
Well, Charlie, you better get to the Ruleur Classic. You're due there very shortly. So, Charlie, thank you very much.
Thanks for lunch. It was delicious.
So, time was up. Charlie had to get to the Ruleur Classic to reveal the new Cannondale Drapac jersey, which turned out to be mostly green and very similar to the 2016 version, although it's made by a different manufacturer, made by POC for the 2017 season. I felt like we covered quite a lot of ground in just under an hour, and I hope you enjoyed listening to Charlie talk about his career and cycling in general. I certainly did. But I was a bit disappointed that he turned down the offer of a starter and dessert. Very disciplined of him. He looks almost like he could still be racing, barely put on any weight since retiring. The same couldn't be said for the person sitting opposite him. But yeah, he didn't have a starter or a dessert. I was a bit disappointed because that meant I didn't feel I could have one either. And there was a couple of things on the menu that did catch my eye. Anyway, Daniel Freeb will be happy to hear that Charlie also observed the rule about not having a cappuccino after 11 o'clock in the morning. But seeing as he spent so long living in Italy, that's probably not a surprise. Thanks very much to our sponsors Rafa and Eurosport, and also to our producer Tom Wally, who has polished this episode into shape. If you've enjoyed it, do let us know. And if you have any ideas about who else from the world of cycling we could invite to lunch or dinner, feel free to make a suggestion on Facebook or on Twitter. We're at @cycling_podcast on Twitter. We do also have Friends of the Podcast programme of episodes. There will be a total of 11 this year, which are available to download to people who sign up and pay the princely sum of £10 for the whole year. So it works out at less than £1 an episode. And the money from that we raise from that basically goes a long, long way to enabling us to produce all of the weekly free episodes. This year we've done more episodes than ever before. Feels like the podcast is continuing to grow. We did the Giro d'Italia daily for the first time this year. We also went to the large chunks of the Vuelta. We've added a cycling podcast, Feminan, so we are delivering more and more content for free. But just because it's free to listen to doesn't mean that it's free to produce. I do understand the irony of making an appeal for funds after I've just had a large lunch, or not so large lunch, but a very nice lunch. But if you do want to ignore that rather awkward juxtaposition and sign up as a friend of the podcast, you can do so on our website at thecyclingpodcast.com. Hopefully lots of people will renew or sign up for 2017 as well. Got lots of exciting plans for next season. And the more people who sign up early, the more additional free content we can plan and get on with. So your support is always very, very welcome. Thanks very much for listening, and it will be back to the regular podcast with me, Richard, and Daniel next week.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.